This episode of The Grape Nation is brought to you by Joule Sous Vide by Chef Steps. Joule takes the guesswork out of cooking. Learn more at chefsteps.com/joule.
I'm HRN's executive director, Katie Mosman Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week, we're looking at the way labels shape our perspectives on food.
I know you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but is it acceptable to judge a wine by its label?
There are some labels that I'd say are so bad they're good.
As long as your paperwork's in good shape, you'll get a grass-fed label.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's Meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Rajat Par. We'll talk wine and words with Raj. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Born in Calcutta, armed with a degree in hospitality from India, and a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America, Raj Par morphed from food to the world of wine. Raj worked with the best in wine, including Larry Stone, Michael Mina, Rubicon, Fifth Floor, and RN74. Always thirsty for more wine and wine challenges, Raj moved into the world of winemaking. He is now the proprietor of Sandy and Domaine de la Cote in California and Eveningland Vineyards in Oregon. Raj Par is a James Beard Award-winning author, celebrated sommelier, sought-after speaker, and is considered to have the best palate in the business. He just wrote a new book with Jordan McKay called The Sommelier's Atlas of Taste. Welcome back to The Grape Nation, Raj.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks. Good to be here.
All right. Congratulations on your new book, The Sommelier's Atlas of Taste, which will be coming out and available when, Raj?
October 23rd.
Okay, October 23rd. Bookstores, Amazon,
everywhere.
Okay.
Probably Amazon's the best deal.
Yeah.
If you want a signed copy, then you got to go to my website, Raj Par Wine Club.
And, you know, at the end of the show, we'll talk about, you know, how you're supporting the book and if people want to meet up with you at some point. And then we'll point them to the website for any dates and all of that.
Yeah.
All right, so let's talk about the book. Multi-pronged question. How did the idea of this book come about? When did you start writing it? How long did it take? And what did it entail?
Took a while. So me and Jordan wrote our first book, The Secrets of Sommelier, in 2011 came out. And so then we, right after that, the publisher asked if we have another idea of a book, and we didn't. So we kind of sat on it for another year and then kind of one day over at dinner, we said, let's find something to, you know, write about, and we decided on this topic, and the Atlas of Taste is in 2012. And then we didn't start any work on it until the end of 2012 when I went to Europe. And the idea of the book was that to have in one book all the classic regions of Europe and discuss in detail why the wines taste the way they taste, specifically from the soil perspective. But also write it in a fun way, because Jordan's writing is very fluid and sometimes funny. So.
Right.
So you can open the book and go into, you know, any region, any classic region, Bordeaux, Jura, Alsace, Wachau, Mosel, and understand the soils, and then kind of talk about why the wines taste.
All in, how much time? 4 years? 5 years?
Of research, 13, 14, 15, 4 years of research.
And how many trips back and forth, if you had to count? Two hands?
Back and forth, probably 10.
Really?
Yeah, many hours in a little car, many days sleeping in a small room, sometimes the same bed, and trying to, you know.
Just but that's sort of the part you relish because you're with the winemakers.
Yeah, yeah.
You're
yeah.
in the field.
No, it was amazing. Right? It was
the connection.
It was amazing. It was, you know, oftentimes cold and you miss home.
Remember
and you,
that, right?
You feel like a green salad and you only get a baguette. So,
right.
You know.
Enough with the baguettes.
Yeah.
All right. So the word taste yeah. obviously is in the title and it is the prevailing theme of the book. So you helped me frame this question from the book, and I want you to explain. Tell me the difference from how does wine taste to why does wine taste like this?
Yeah.
And I think the book moves more towards why does wine taste like this?
Yeah.
So explain that and differentiate.
Yeah. I think that the word taste is the most important part of the title because oftentimes wine is mistaken just on the nose. To really understand the wine, the taste, you know, the texture, the flavor profile, the concentration, the minerality, it's all in your mouth. And our tongue is what really, you know, feels the sensation of the wine. The nose is great, you can smell it, and it's a very important part of the wine. But to really discuss the place, it's the taste, it's the tannin, it's the fruit, it's the density of the wine. And this book is very focused on minerality and flavor of wine and sense of place.
So we taste wine and we say, how does it taste? What you're saying is, why does it taste?
Why does it taste?
And all the things you mentioned, tannins yeah.
And
all that.
Yeah, and it all comes from the soil.
People don't think of that.
Yes, in the soil, you know, because as the same grape grown on limestone versus granite will have a different taste.
Right.
And that's just the way the vines have grown and the same grape and can right. taste. And that, so we're discussing, there are a lot of comparisons in the book about, you know, difference between, you know, Sancerre and Puy Fumé or, you know, Bouvray, Mont Louis versus like, you know, Savinier or versus, you know, Saumur Blanc, and those are all, it's the place where it's planted,
right.
you know.
Right. All right, so how do we taste? Do we taste with our mouth? Do we taste with our nose? Is it a combination? When people put it in their mouth, is it really their mouth that's working, or is it something,
it's,
you know,
yes.
deeper involving your olfactory?
So I don't give too much away, but the first chapter is very intense, and there's like a lot of research done on this topic of what our tongue tastes. You know, we've got to taste from our body, you know?
Right.
In your tongue, and it instinctually just, it goes to your mind, and you have a, you know, sense memory of childhood or of yesterday or of, you know, whatever. And then our body comes in play because it's, you know, it's very visceral. It's not just like, oh, just shoot it and we're out. You know, it's the wine has, the energy of the wine comes, starts in your tongue, goes into your brain, and then your whole body feels it. That's why when you have a great, you know, sip of wine, you're like, wow, this tastes, because, you know, it's, you know, your brain cells are like, wow, this is amazing. What is, this reminds me of this, or this gives me this kind of sensation.
So one of the things you said in the book, although it's not scientific, because a lot of it is emotional and you, there was some science and you allude to that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't want to ruin it, read the book. But does the science say, because you talk about an emotion too, you
yeah.
know, it goes in your mouth, into your body and your brain and all of that. Are we tasting as much as we're smelling as much as we're tasting, or is it really the taste touch part?
The taste. I think it's the taste, and that's something I've been saying for many years. It's the taste, and then that kind of triggers off the emotion in your brain. And to really get a sense of place, you must taste the wine.
Right.
And one of the things also, it's fine if you spit the wine out, but you don't get the same emotion
right.
until you swallow it. And then the first sip and you're like, wow, this is like, you know.
But you know better than anyone that when you go to a tasting,
oh, of course.
You have to sweat,
yeah,
spit.
Yeah.
But if you are with 100%. Friends drinking wines,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, the real sensory experience is
100%.
You know, getting it in the mouth, aerating and all of that.
Yeah.
All right. Tell me why in the book, it kept coming up. Words like minerality and terroir are so controversial.
Yeah.
I mean, you seem to take exception to those. And terroir has sort of morphed into another word in the book to you, which, I think you said typicity.
Yeah, typicity.
So why are words like minerality and terroir?
I think that, a grape is a fruit.
Okay.
And we love fruit. But then to get a sense of place, it might have a connection with what's under the vine. And that's the rocks and the soil and the clay, whatever the case may be. And the word minerality is the expression of the grape from the place. And it's the only word you can use. I mean, even though that word is controversial and we address it in the first chapter, you can't taste the minerals. You cannot taste the minerals from the soil in the wine, but there is a relationship between the soil and the wine, and that is, it's where the vines are grown.
But you said earlier, you take the same wine, a Sancerre or something, and it's either on limestone, schist, or granite. I mean, those are rocks, minerals, and all that.
Yeah.
Can you not say minerality and go, this is a very schisty Sancerre, this is a very granity, or you don't even want to go there?
Yeah, you can go in there, but the typicity, we didn't do that much soil science, and you do feed minerality, but it's not the same mineral.
Right.
Like limestone gives you kind of a salty taste, and maybe granite gives you kind of bitterness, and that's just, that's what we feel, right? And we are not soil scientists to kind of, maybe in the next 50 years, there will be some studies and to find out what the compounds in the wine are relating to the compounds in the soil, but we want to stick to the word minerality, because when you taste a wine from limestone or from silex or from granite, you do get specific flavors, and that's what we kind of narrow down on in the book.
Right. So for me, tell me what typicity is. Just give me the definition compared to terroir, how you integrate it and use it.
Yeah, so terroir is like a macro word of the place, what's below the vine, what's above the vine. That means the area, the weather, the soil, the vine material.
So a lot of people think of terroir as just like the ground or the dirt. Talking about the place.
It's the whole, the space below and above.
That's terroir.
That's terroir.
Okay.
It's a very, very complicated word, and we try to use it as little as possible because it has so many different meanings.
Right.
And now we use typicity more because typicity relates directly from the soil grape wine.
Soil grape wine.
So basically the typicity of, Chardonnay grown on limestone versus Chardonnay grown on clay or sand or any grape you can, that we want to keep it kind of a direct link from the soil, the grape, and the wine in the bottle or in the glass.
All right, so I'm a little confused, but you'll help me with it. This is a good time to ask you and introduce how the human factor plays into this. And I think there's two areas where the human factor is a big deal. I think terroir or place and climate, which I think you said was part of terroir, but not necessarily typicity.
So
the human factor, how does that interact with the terroir?
Yeah.
And climate change. I think that's important.
I think the human factor is maybe one of the most important things, because vines grow on their own, but vine needs, you need to trellis it, you need to prune it, you need to, do whatever you do on your canopy, and then you have to harvest it. So all this...
A lot of attention.
Yeah, so it's...
But you also left out that a guy just takes a barren piece of land and from nothing starts a vineyard.
100%.
I mean, that's a total human factor interaction, right?
What you planned, how you planned, what direction you planned. So it's very much, man-made.
So is that a good thing, a bad thing?
It is what it is.
I
mean, there are abandoned vineyards from a long time ago, but, you can't, it's not always going to you know, exist and be great. So that's the first, the human factor of like how a person, you know, a man or woman, they plant and they take care of the vines. Then when you pick the grapes, then you have to pay attention on the cellar. You have to.
And you talk of winemaking.
Yeah, so then the word winemaking is like just take the grapes through fermentation, right? Age it, bottle it. And these are all things which a person does. It doesn't become on its own. If you let the juice just ferment and leave it alone, it's going to become, the goal is it's going to become vinegar.
Right.
So you have to, you know, do whatever to it, rack it and sulfur it, don't sulfur it, whatever the case may be. You don't.
Right.
But so that, the human factor is huge. So that is a big part of terroir also, because a person's, his own idea of the wine.
His expression.
Is his expression. And, right. And so now you have a human factor as a part of the terroir also. And you could change the terroir because, you know, if you do a whole cluster, you do destemmed. So all these things are, you know.
So when you talk about place or terroir, it plays into the wine. But the reality is the human factor, how wine is touched,
yeah,
has such an impact on it. Now, the natural wine movement, they're low interventionists and all that. There's organics, biodynamics, and all of that. I would guess that would play a positive factor.
Very positive. Because
terroir in the earth.
Yeah, the mycorrhizae, the, you know, all the good.
What about all climate? The microbes. I mean, is climate changing? Is it affecting harvest?
Oh, for sure. Climate
is it something winemakers can control.
Climate is changing.
Is it out of control?
Climate is changing rapidly. Not necessarily hotter or colder. It's just erratic. There's those, you know, what you had a consistency of the weather is completely out of wax.
And so that, give me examples when you're farming.
I'll give you an example. I mean, the best example I'll give you is in Beaujolais, for example, right? It was many vintages. It was, you know, you can barely get to ripeness and you can make a wine at 12.5%, and that's it. And now you have a string of vintages, which are warm vintages and sometimes low cropped due to hail or frost, and you have to pick at ripeness, and the wines are much riper. In the last, if you taste...
What are you talking, like 14, 15, 16?
Yeah.
Those vintages have been...
Not 15, especially 15? 15, yeah. 17, 18. You see a lot of Beaujolais at above 14%.
Big time climate influenced.
Yeah, wines. So that's kind of, you know, same with Burgundy. You used to have to chaptalize and kind of like, you know, get to 12.5%, 13%, and now it's naturally at 13.5%, 14%.
Jesus.
So, you know, I mean, so that's going to change the typicity or, you know, what you call the place, the sense of place might be different. And it's just evolving, you know. Nothing is constant.
You have three wineries, different areas. Two are in California, one's in Oregon. Are you feeling it there? I mean, every harvest is a different challenge.
Yeah, so like we had the opposite one this year in Santa Rita Hills. I think we had like one day above 90 degrees. One.
Is that not typical?
No, we usually have several days above 90. But
so it was cooler.
Coldest vintage since 11.
Don't you like a cool vintage?
I do, but I'm going to give an example. I love it. We picked into October, which is amazing.
Right.
Which is like, you know, picking Chardonnay in the beginning of October, is that crazy? In 14, 15, crazy. 16, we picked Chardonnay in the middle of August.
Wow. You had to get it off the vines.
I mean, this is kind of crazy.
Here's the perfect example.
3 years you pick on August 15th, and then 1 year you pick on, like, you know, October 7th. That's not close.
And you have no idea next year to plan.
Yeah, that's 6 weeks after the previous. I mean, it's just so.
Now, when you I know you talk to old timers. I mean, vintages were challenging, but was it as drastic as now? I mean, when people look back.
I mean, there's still drastic vintages, but you know what now is you have to be a lot more focused on viticulture because things are changing so quickly. You know, you don't know if you're going to, you know, is your May going to be, are you going to flowering in May? Are you going to like flowering in June? You know, what's happening? It's just
a little unnerving.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you could have a day, you know, I was in Burgundy last week, and it was like 80 degrees.
In October?
In Beaune. I was just like, wait a minute. This is
kind of crazy.
I got there, I had my jacket, wow, I need like a sweater. No, wow. I need like a t-shirt. No, like, everything wow. is... Wow,
that's crazy.
Yeah, so, you know, things...
All right, we're talking to Raja Parr. Raja's new book is The Sommelier's Atlas of Taste. Raja, in the book, you covered classic wine countries, regions, grapes, mostly Europe or Europe, France, Italy, Austria, Germany, and Spain. You left out some regions.
Yep.
How did you decide, you know, on the final list? I think you'll make most people happy, but may look for Portugal.
Oh, yeah, Portugal, Greece.
Not putting you on the spot, but how did you come to your...
I think that we had a timeline, right. Of how long we got to finish the book in, and we tried to find a vein, a story we can tell of the place. There are regions we tasted, which we didn't include in the book, because
I'd rather not give you
an example, because
is that the Sommelier's Atlas of Taste Part Two?
Yeah, no, you know, there's a few because we didn't find, you know, the story, and then we could have included Greece and definitely Portugal,
right?
But I think that the wine evolution is happening now, and it's, of course, port is well known, and,
right.
and Douro is well known, and there's other things happening. And in Greece, there's so much happening.
Yeah.
But it would take us, you know, months of more, and we just decided to just stick with.
So nothing was really left out, like almost with Greece, not ready yet, or.
No, it's.
Greek wines are great.
Yeah,
and the area is
but it would.
You had time constriction.
It would have taken a longer time to understand, because there's. You know, and also, I mean, look at Italy. Italy could have, you know, we only wrote basically, you know, Tuscany, Piedmont, and Sicily, basically Etna. So also wines which are like, which you can smell and taste, and it takes you right there.
Right.
It wasn't about, you know, really a discovery of, because we could have included other regions in Italy, but, you know, also places where we actually could find data on the soil.
Right.
A lot of places in Italy, we couldn't find it
right.
on the soil.
Right, so it would dictate
extent
of how you can get
it. Yeah, and some places there are only two or three producers who are at the top. So, you know, we have to also have a sample set of producers. And
you know, when I ask you this, it's not like the book's not a hefty coffee table book. I mean, it's pretty, you know, substantial. And, you know, like you said, you walk through some of the other regions. So, you know, we'll see down the road. I realize in the book, as I read through it, there's pretty much of a template, in a good way.
Yeah.
And I wrote it down. I mean, you basically talk about country, region, varietals. You have a discussion of place and taste, which is really, I think, an important part of the soul of the book. And a cool thing is every region, you pick your top picks, you know, which is nice. So when you read through this, you go, what should I drink? And there it is, you know, Raj's picks. Walk me through the setup for all of that.
So,
I mean,
so,
did you imagine that before you wrote it?
No. So all the writing Jordan wrote, and because, you know, He's a way better writer than I am, so he does all the writing, sends it back to me, and I can take a look, and we kind of talk about what to add or take away, and then you have the person who actually edits the book, in this case, Emily Timberlake. She works, you know, at 10 Speed and based in California, and so she built the template, because she took all the writing and kind of like, because it has, like, you know, you want to be consistent in all regions, but.
So you had all this vast information.
Yeah.
When you realize it was all out there, there were silos for Italy.
There was
this discussion of taste.
Cause
there was regions and varietals.
It's all different. If you look at every region could have a different angle, but you have to find a consistent way. So if a reader wants to like go on to read about Piedmont or, you know, or about Burgundy or the Jura. You have, like, you know, you have a consistent, and that's what makes an amazing project to work with someone like Tenspeed, who they have a team of people.
They got it right.
They do editing. That's what they do.
Yeah.
And that was very important to kind of, you know, put that in context, because many, you know, when you write a book, you can just keep writing.
Right.
And then there's no real kind of way
structure
to kind of, you know, we want this book to be, you know, of course, we read, but also a reference book.
Well, I was going
to
ask you that.
You want to go back to it.
When you look at the book, there's a lot of soul and feeling and opinion, and then there's a lot of information.
Yeah.
I said to you before the show, you know, for my show, it becomes a reference book. If I have a guest on, you know, we're talking about Beaujolais or whatever, or Burgundy, you know, the information in there. So did you intend it to be a reference book?
Absolutely. No, that was the idea in the beginning. It was a reference book. Because you can go back, and if someone who is just first time having Beaujolais or is a Beaujolais expert wants to kind of quickly go and say, oh, yeah, what do we have in Moulin Vent? What's the story of Moulin Vent? Well, you know, what's Brewery all about? And you go in there, boom, check out the breweries. Okay, that, you know, or you go to, like, you know, Jura. What are the different soils, and, you know, what makes Jura different than Burgundy, because they're so close and the soils are somewhat similar in a way. So just, you know, that, because you come back to it, and it's in one book. You can go to, you know, we could have included so many other regions, but
any regrets that you didn't, or you explained why.
Yeah,
but
now that
covers are on, it's like shit.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, honestly, we didn't, like, the one region I would have loved to add, but we didn't have enough data to, is Savoie.
Ah.
You know, that would have been amazing. I love the region, but, you know, it was hard to put it in a chapter, because it's different parts. I mean, you could drive a Jura. You want to, if you go 10 miles, you could take you 2 hours.
Right.
You could go up a hill and go down. It's, you know, it's so...
So
but
this ain't your last book, so we could figure out where to park. It's a big under.
I tell you,
that oof was unsolicited. I'm not ready to do that in the near future. Is that what that was?
Yeah, start to finish, 6 years.
Okay.
And then, you know.
Did it take longer to write this book than?
Oh, my God.
Okay.
No, the first book we wrote from beginning to end was less than 12 months.
Oh, okay.
This book was 5 years of research.
Yeah, well, on the ground.
Yeah.
I mean,
we went to every, like, we wrote about places we went to. It wasn't like we wrote about places and people we didn't talk to. Everything is recorded. We have recordings of every interview on the place.
You sit down.
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't like we took something out of nowhere and just wrote about it.
Right. It was very well thought out.
If something is missing in the book, it's because we didn't go there. So people might say,
missing's not even the word. You didn't get there, or, you know, you'll get there eventually, or whatever. This was a curiosity of mine. I mean, I kind of know the answer, but you got to answer it. You devoted like 16 pages to Bordeaux and over 60 pages to Burgundy. I mean, I counted them twice to make sure I wasn't wrong. I know you love Burgundy, you know, so that
I love Bordeaux too.
I know. But I guess the question is, what the hell happened to Bordeaux? I mean, it was a fraction of the pages.
I'm not
indicting you
or the
coverage, but why does that play out that way? Is Burgundy so enthralling and thrilling to you? Is there that much there? Or is Bordeaux easier to explain and less pages?
Yeah, I think Bordeaux is easier to explain because the geology of Bordeaux is complex, but it's not as complex as Burgundy.
Okay.
And the examples...
And that's what this book digs into.
And the examples of those, the differences, is also portrayed in the wine. Because, as you know, from 1 hectare of vines, you could have, you know, 5 producers making wine from 1 hectare.
In Burgundy.
Yeah, in Burgundy. Yeah. So you are like, okay, so now you have 5 people's expression of that little piece of land versus in Bordeaux, you know, it's yeah,
5 different explanations.
Yeah, and then you have, you know, you have a chateau which might own, like, you know, 25 to 50 hectares.
Right.
And then they make one wine out of that. So, you know,
that explains it a little, for sure.
But, you know, also the art of blending, it makes Bordeaux. and it's the opposite in Burgundy. It's the art of not blending. Well, what if someone decides to blend, you know, Musigny with
doesn't happen.
You know, with Richebourg and right. with Chambertin?
Doesn't happen.
So, you know, so we have three explanations for
right. And those are good ones.
So that's why, I mean, it's funny. Trust me, I love Bordeaux, and I tell you, of a whole trip, it was our favorite part.
Bordeaux?
Yeah, it was amazing.
You even gave the Rhone more pages than Bordeaux.
Oh, Rhone is so much bigger and wider.
No, I know.
And
that requires all the coverage and everything.
Yeah, different wines. Yeah, yeah.
Daniel Jonas was recently on the show, and he taught, you know, I asked him similar question because he's truly a Francophile and a Burgundian. He stated, you know, in Burgundy, you're in the cellar with the winemaker, and if you look at his hands, they're basically purple. You go to Bordeaux, and, you know, the guy owns a big chateau with a custom-made suit. No indictment against it, but it's a different vibe and all of that. But your explanation is real. I mean, there's just so much more, you know, involvement and detail in Burgundy.
It's Bordeaux's grand. You know, the Cabernet is one of the grandest grapes in the world, for sure. There's no doubt. But in context to, I mean, if in Bordeaux, if each, I won't say they should, but if each chateau decides to do five different bottlings from their property around, it could become like Burgundy. It's not, because they are, the soils are, you could go from
Didn't Al Bronstein do that at,
Of course. Diamond Creek, they still do.
Took the terroir in a small, you know, area.
Yeah, so
they don't do it in Bordeaux, though.
Well, it's, you know, it's like Hermitage. It's the art of blending.
Right.
I mean, you know, Jean-Louis Chauve can make seven different wines from his property.
And he does.
And he makes one, sometimes two. So, you know, so that's just, that's a cultural idea, right?
Right.
So, of course, you have the soil, but remember that all these things are very cultural.
Right.
And Champagne is very similar. I mean, now you see these little single crew, blah, 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 from everywhere.
Is that grower Champagne?
Even like Krug is making the, you know, Ambonnet and Menil, so you know
they're designating.
Yeah, but think if every of the Grand Marks say, oh yeah, I'm going to make, you know, 10 different bottlings, it could change the game really quickly.
Do you see that? Take Champagne specifically. Do you see a movement towards that?
You know, Champagne is also a very complex. You know,
it's different unto its own.
Yeah. So even though the many of the big producers are brands, but within them they realize they have these little crews and these little vineyards which are like, you know, which stand out. So, right. So do you blend it together with the massive blend or bottle it separately?
Do you think you're going to see? Well, you said
you already see it from other producers. Right. Jacques-Casson does all these different bottlings and.
Right.
Yeah. No. You're already seeing it. I mean.
Some guys are bottling 4, 6, 8 different bottlings.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
From
yeah.
you know one relatively small vineyard.
Yeah.
Right. After writing the book and you know the script was done, I mean, was there any region or anything that you became even more excited about or energized after doing the book?
You know,
you look back and go, wow, that. I didn't realize the Rhone or, you know, Bordeaux, whatever.
You know,
any change?
Yeah, so a region I visited many, many times and I fell in love deeper was Piedmont. And to really kind of, you know, love the wines, I've been there many, many times, but then to really taste and visit different vineyards and kind of, you know, see the...
You got into it the way you had gotten into
other vineyards
and winemakers in Burgundy or whatever.
It's one of the most important wine places on the planet, and it's the soil diversity, the people producing wine there, the whole culture, the everything about it. You know, it's one of the most amazing places.
Would you say that? In your day-to-day, week-to-week, year-to-year travels, of all the wines that you taste, drink, go out, for business and not? I mean, are you drinking less Barolo? So the fact that, or wines from Piedmont. So the fact that you were there,
you drink a lot anyway. Not a lot, because you know, I mean,
less than other wines.
You know, you have to be in the right state of mind. You can't just sit at home and say, "Oh yeah, I want a bottle of wine. Let's open a bottle of Barolo."
Yeah,
we had a bottle last night at Fausto. We had a bottle of 05 Rinaldi, Beppe Rinaldi.
Rest in peace.
Brunate. But you know, it's not a wine you can just open and say, "Oh yeah, I'm gonna sip on the wine." But if you have a great dinner with great bottles of wine, that is one of the greatest. I mean, it's up there with the great Bordeaux and the Burgundies and anything else.
It's as great for that as any wine.
Yeah. And the ageability and still, I mean, in the high echelon, but still the value is still there.
Right. So when the book was done, the Piedmont region, he felt, you know, even better about
that
it.
We made several trips. I mean, with Jordan, I was there once, but before that, to do other research, I was there twice before.
So you brought up an interesting thing by saying that. In all the research, I assume you and Jordan were together a lot, but there was a lot of times where you...
We were together. So before I took Jordan to all these places, I went myself because to find what would be, you know, the who to see. So you do a little triage of, you know, you go see whatever, 30 producers, and then you narrow it down, you're going to see five.
You do the advance work.
Yeah. So you know, the
and
triage.
And then Jordan's with you when you're getting down to it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Jordan and me, we did together, I think, 4 months in Europe over 3 years. But before that, I did myself. You know, the first 3 years I did my own.
Good amount of time, alone and together.
Yeah, so I can't take notes anymore. I'm done.
You're done.
I'm like, you know, no more taking notes on every wine
you taste.
That's
it. Just drink it and enjoy it.
Yeah.
We're talking to Raj Parr. Raj's new book is The Sommelier's Atlas of Taste. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, a couple more questions. I want to talk to Raj about his wineries, current harvest and bottlings. I want to subject him to our wine list and a few other things. You're listening to The Grape Nation. I'm Sam Ben Ruby. We'll be right back. This episode is brought to you by Jules Sous Vide. Hey. You can host the most delicious dinner and wine parties this holiday season with Jewel. I'm going to tell you how. When you cook with Jewel, there's zero guesswork. So steak, chicken, seafood, turkey, roast, eggs all come out exactly the way you like them. This gives you plenty of time to taste test your wine and food pairings course by course. And cooking with Jewel is hands-free, so you can focus on your holiday guests, watch the game, perfect your recipes, and most importantly, making sure you have enough wine to serve with your great food while Jewel does the work. Jewel, perfect food every time. To get yours, visit chefsteps.com/Jewel. That's chefsteps.com/JOULE and use the code HRN to get $15 off for a limited time. That's chefsteps.com/JOULE, code HRN. All right, Raj, one last thing before we get into what's going on with your wines and wineries. I asked you, you know, what region you were excited, energized about, Piedmont. What's your biggest takeaway, memory, challenge from writing the book? I mean, when you look back...
I think the travel was tough in the winter months, and those were
just physically.
It was, and just to every day be on it. And if you're in the winter, sometimes you're sick, but you got to be on.
You're not feeling it.
If you're gonna go see one producer, the only time for the book, you better have game face ready to go. It wasn't like, you know, you can't tell someone who you had appointment 6 months ago, say, oh, I can't, you know, I'm not going to show up or something. So, you know, that it was physically really, you know.
Demanding.
It was, yeah. And you got to be on. And we both of us, you know, sometimes I was not feeling well and Jordan wasn't. So we step it up. So Jordan stepped up like
right.
some place where I was like, you know, because, you know, this is, we had normal jobs. And this we snuck all these things right. in. It wasn't like we took
right. a We're 3 years. We're going to talk about your winery. That's not yeah. a hobby.
No, it was a huge sacrifice. my business partner, Sashi Mormon, who allowed me to go
right.
and just, you know, it was, instead of you go out and sell wine, or you go and research for your book. So, it was, you know, there was sacrifices made by everyone,
right.
Especially my...
Including what you pointed out is the hard work,
yeah.
the years of it, and having to put yourself up to it.
Yeah.
I mean, are you with, like, one of the greatest winemakers and you have a cold? You can't smell crap?
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's like, oh, boy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, right? So, you know, just a lot of echinacea and...
yeah.
No, but all in all, it was, you know, just, and also to kind of...
Labor of love.
Yeah, keep focused and get the relevant information to kind of, you know, crunch it in. And that's, you know, that was also because there's so much information. We could have written a book five times that size. But you have to also, you have, you know, the number of words that the publisher wants. You can't just... You know, it's not a self-published book. You have to still
right.
be the parameters. And
so even that was a discipline because it's a big, lengthy, detailed book.
Yeah.
God. All right, let's talk about what you're doing back in the States. Let's talk about
my real job?
Yeah, let's get to your real job now. You got this stupid book out of the way. No, congrats on the book. We'll tell everyone where to get it. So how are things at your wineries? Let's tell everybody you have Sande Winery,
yep.
Domaine de la Cote. And I think around 2014-ish, you took over Seven Springs Evening
yeah,
Land.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So quickly, just, you know, let's not assume everyone knows everything. Just give me a quick walkthrough on each winery.
Yes.
Sande was your first?
Yeah.
2011?
So Sashi Mormon, my partner in crime in all our wineries. So he and I, we started Sande in 2009. And then Domaine de la Cote. First vintage 2011, and then we acquired the historic Seven Springs Vineyard. Evening Land was the name of the company, and that was
Oregon
in the Willamette Valley in the Eolamity Hills, and that was 2014. So now, anyway, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay in all three wines. Sande is mostly from grapes we buy and vines we rent. Mostly from that.
Right.
Now we
Pinot,
also
Chard.
Pinot Chardonnay only.
Right.
And Domaine de la Cote is mostly Pinot. Sande is mostly Chardonnay. And that, so Domaine de la Cote is our estate vineyard, which Sashi and Chris King planted. And
the vineyards are in?
In the Santa Rita Hills. So we focus, Domaine de la Cote is all Santa Rita Hills. Sande is Santa Rita Hills and Santa Maria, right. and a Santa Barbara County bottling. And then Oregon, it's only Seven Springs Vineyard, all estate,
right.
all from our property.
Pinot and Chard.
Pinot, Chardonnay, a little bit of Gamay.
The Gamay is only from Seven Springs?
Seven Springs and a little bit of Chenin Blanc.
Okay. I've had the Gamay. It's very good. Domaine de la Cote is your vineyards where you can express different...
Yeah, it's our estate.
You know, tell me about some of the name designations.
Yeah, so we
cracked Blooming Field the other night.
So we have four single parcel bottlings: Memorias, Bloomsfield, La Cote, and Siren's Call, and on four different soils, same plant material, same planting year, same vinification, no additives. So just to express the place.
And so that winemaker loves that because you have different sites and the expressions.
Yeah, so we don't change anything in the wine. We kind of keep it the way it is. And, yeah, it was a dream
All right, so if people want to drink and get their hands on Raj Parr's wines, what's the best thing they should do? Go to each site?
Yeah. You know.
Sande is Sandhi.
Yeah. So
I'm assuming that's an Indian word.
It is.
It's
a Sanskrit word. Means collaboration or unity.
Okay.
Because it's all negociant. We buy, we work with different growers.
Right.
And that's the...
So Sandy is Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. Yeah. From California. Just Google it. Yeah. Domaine de la Côte is an estate-grown... Yeah. Multi-vineyard.
Santa Rita Hills, yeah.
Santa Rita Hills, Pinots and some Chards.
Yep.
And for Oregon fans, yeah. You have your hands in...
Seven Springs.
In Seven Springs, Chard, Pinot, and a little Gamay and Chenin. I'm sure it's pretty limited what's available and all of that. did I see, in relation to these wineries or some of them, that you started a wine club?
Yeah. So
tell me about that.
I mean, we love Pinot Noir Chardonnay, of course, and, you know, I always have, always need things to kind of push us, and so we decided to do a little wine club where we make other wines, well, other grapes. We have, Cabernet, Napa Valley Cabernet from Coombsville. Made a Merlot from Coombsville. You know, this year we had a little Zinfandel from Lodi, some Pais from Amador.
So is that the objective of the club, to offer wines that are not the core grapes of...
Yeah.
And is there any of the Sandy Domaine de la Côte or other stuff in the wine club, or it's all...
We haven't done...
That's a cool concept.
Yeah, you know, we did some kind of a carbonic Pinot from another vineyard, which we don't make for Sandy, and... And, you know, there's some skin contact Pinot Gris. There's different. There's a, you know, and also looking at the vineyard sources, like people, like, you know, people who farm, you know,
right,
organically and that kind of stuff. So we keep it in the same idea of all the other wines, but we make it in the same way with no additives and...
Right, your philosophy.
Yeah, character. The same.
So this is your way of getting in the sandbox and playing with other toys.
Exactly.
Right?
And Mourvedre from the Anne's Vineyard, right. Cabernet from up in, you know, Carmel.
So just quickly tell me about the process. Do you... Like, are you thinking now about next year you're going to make a Grenache or some of the Italian white? Or
yeah, Grenache this year. Maybe Grenache this year. That's right. Yeah, no, you know, it's... I think that...
A little more spontaneous.
Yeah,
or,
but good vineyard sources, people we know, farming, which is done the right way.
Will things come about when somebody says, I got a lot of extra juice, do you want to do it, or
no,
it's not
no,
that?
No, okay. You know, it's very... And every wine has inspiration from another wine. Right. So it's not just like, it's random, but not that random.
Right. Well, if I want to find out more about the wine club, where should I go?
Just Rosh Par Wine Club.
Okay.
That's the website.
Just Google it, or it's Rosh Par Wine Club.
RoshParWineClub.com. It's there. It's
That would be a fun and interesting play for people.
Yeah.
Because if you love Raj and Raj's wines, you know, he gets his hands on some other things, and
all the wines made by us. It's not
right.
It's not contracted out by anyone. It's all we make the wine either in Lompoc or in Salem.
Are you still in the restaurant biz?
Yeah.
Do you talk about that?
Yeah. You know, I've worked with Michael Mina since 2002.
Okay, that's a
long
time.
So I'm off the floor. I don't do operations, but I still kind of, you know, keep an eye on the flagship restaurant.
Still involved with him.
Yeah, he's family. He's like, you know, it's our lives, and I'm around as much as he wants, and I have a small restaurant in Santa Barbara
called
BBG. It's Indian.
Which is the brother or sister to New York?
Yeah, so
Babaji?
Jesse, who started Babaji.
Jesse Singh,
and then he opened BBG, and then we were partners, and then he left. He moved to back home to Melbourne.
Right, he's an Australian Indian.
Yeah, and now the restaurant is run by Alejandro Medina and Gary Singh, who are the chef and the general manager. They basically own most of the restaurant, and they operate it. And I'm just there to eat and drink.
Make sure the right wine is on the shelf.
Which,
when you talked about being with Michael Mina, I mean, you really started on the floor and everything and helped him build that whole wine reputation. I always ask guys like you, you know, what was that reason or motivation from moving from sommelier to winemaker to winery owner? Is it something that was always in your plans, or you realize I want to, or I got to do this?
No, it was not
because
planned.
You're in it deep, man.
Yeah.
You know, you're not. I mean, we have a lot of friends, a lot of guys who've been on the show who have a little winery or a piece, 400 case. You know, you're in deep. How did that come about?
You know, it just happened by chance, because when I was working in the floor, I was just curious how wine is made. So I started making a little bit of wine in Santa Barbara, a little bit in, you know, other places, and just to kind of understand what, you know, how wine is made.
Was it as much that as I got to get off the floor? Or
no.
It wasn't.
No,
you enjoyed the floor.
Yeah.
You were intrigued by.
Oh, first vintage, 04 till 08, when we were making Par Selection wines, it was just like, just for fun, a little bit right here and there, just to kind of, and then we got serious with Sandy in 09. But I didn't move to Santa Barbara until 2013 because I still worked the floor.
Right.
So I still, for harvest, I should
in
come
San
back.
San Francisco.
Yeah.
Santa Barbara's south.
Lompoc was 4 hours away.
Right. So it's not a morning drive.
So sometimes I went back and forth the same day.
Eesh.
So, you know, but anyway, but then slowly I was like, wow, this is like, it's actually something I really enjoy, and eventually just wanted to have a kind of a
and still simpler, enjoy.
Oh, I love it.
Fulfills your expectations, challenges.
I love living in Santa Barbara, and I know I can, you know, always come to San Francisco. I don't go there that often. But
you're a pretty good traveler.
But yeah, I just drive. It's, you know, it's longer.
I guess right now, you know, you're a frantic, frenetic guy, your lifestyle, but do you take that deep breath, because the book's behind you now? I know you have to promote it, but is
huge.
That a weight off your shoulder you can enjoy, get back to certain things?
No, I'm looking forward to the book tour, and then I'm looking forward to just being home
right
after that, and, you know.
We'll talk about the book tour in a minute. Raj, before I let you go, I want to subject you to our wine list, because our listeners, and certainly I am very curious about our guests and important guests like you, are drinking. So we ask you 5 questions. We did this the last time you were here. I know you don't remember the questions, and you didn't prepare for them, so let's buzz through them. All right, so the first question on the Raj Parr wine list is, what are you drinking now? What's on the table? What are you tasting, experimenting? Is it for work? Are you intrigued with the area? Or?
I guess.
Now, seasonal.
Yeah, because now we're into fall.
Right.
So it definitely, you know, transitioning, you know, I think we've...
So what does that mean?
Put our rosés aside.
Okay.
You know, move into a little, more in like Gamay and some Trousseau, something kind of fresh and crunchy, and, you know, that's always in the mix, you know. So have Gamay is probably, you know, I probably drink more Gamay during.
You know, Daniel Jonas, I said, was on the show, and I said Beaujolais is just kind of blown up, or it's having its day, and it's just a very drinkable. You know, do you have a couple of favorite producers or wines you like?
Oh, yeah. You know, the classics, La Pierre, Fouillard, are always great. But there's a lot of new producers. There's
one
new producer. They're good friends, and I was just with them recently. Domaine Chapelle.
C-H-A-P-E-L?
C-H-A-P-E-L.
The husband and wife?
Yeah, exactly.
Michelle?
Yeah, Michelle Smith, who's to be at Brooklyn Fair. And then
right.
With her husband, they have this one, 2 kids. And, yeah, they got a nice little small domain there. And
you're not the only person who's brought them up, so they must be doing. Now, you said Trousseau. You're talking French and American, mostly French. Give me a Trousseau favorite.
You know, I'm saying French, American, okay. Spanish. You know, it's
okay.
I mean, the grape, you know, the French might argue this, but my research says that grape is from Galicia.
Really?
Yeah.
So the Spanish Trousseaus could be great.
Yeah, yeah. So Bastarda or Menantau, depending.
Nice.
Because they have so many different names. So, you know, I mean,
give me a Trousseau. What good one?
You know, I love from Jura, Stéphane Tissot.
Classic. That's a good one. Say no more.
Yeah.
All right. I always ask people favorite wine and food pairing, something you go back to.
It's always the same for me, you know? It's always...
I should remember this. What is it?
It's always Zuni Cafe roast chicken.
Chicken and vino?
And no. And Allemande Cornas. Ah. It's always the same. That's okay. Like, it's this.
You know what? I have to look up. You were on the show a couple of years ago. I got to see if that's what you said.
Oh, it's.
But I mean, Zuni makes the greatest chicken in the country. Alamon is the great corn. It's just a great. Yeah. You know, that's a classic. And in the couple of years I've been doing the show, people have said chicken and other stuff, but not Zuni chicken and Alamon cornas.
Yeah.
That's a good one. You could go New York, you can go Europe, you can go San Fran, you can go Santa Barbara. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar? Just a place that's fun to go into. The selection is great. Yeah. The people are great. The wine knowledge.
Oh, it's,
you know, you're not leaving any friends out, but you know what? What feels good when you do it?
I'll probably give two restaurants because they both are like my favorite. For different reasons. One is Pasquale Jones.
Okay.
Right here in New York. And the other one is Ventre in Paris.
V-A-N-T-R-E?
V-A-N-T-R-E.
Right.
It is one
of the... Is it new or old?
Yeah, it's new.
It's relatively
It's new. One of the greatest wine restaurants in the world.
Really? Is it fancy?
It's casual. Casual? Little, simple, bistro-like restaurant in Paris, owned and run by a good friend, Marco Pelletier, who also makes a little wine called Domaine de Galouche. And
so the wine list, the food, everything's working.
It's very personal. He has a lot of wines in his own cellar. He has a lot of classic wines, natural wines. It's tiny. Open lunch, dinner, just a great spot.
I tell everyone this. I post all your answers on our social media. We do a Raj Par wine list. We'll put it on Facebook. We'll put it on Instagram. That'll come after the show. All right. Do you... This will be interesting because I'll compare it to the last show. And it doesn't have to be one. Favorite all-time wine. And that doesn't mean the most expensive, the rarest. It could be experiential. It could, you know, what today, if you had to answer that question?
Favorite? Oh, wow. This is a pretty, well, oof. This is a loaded. So today, as of now,
I look up the answer, it was different last time.
Yeah.
What's resonating with you today?
You know, it's Syrah. We've moved. You know, because for some reason.
Get me to region. Are you talking Cornas? Are you talking
Saint Joseph? Cornas Saint Joseph, probably. You know,
like, little age on it, or even current vintages.
You know,
give me a couple of makers you love.
There's basically two.
Gonon.
There's Gonon and Chav. And, you know, that's a good Tuesday night wine, and that's a good Saturday night wine.
Okay.
And
that's just a favorite.
Still, yeah, you know, you're talking to me in October. It's going to get cold now, so.
No. That's what we're talking about now. That's a nice thing.
Good crunchy Syrah from the Northern Rhone.
All right, those are good ones. All right, I ask everybody this. I have different types. I have winemakers, sommeliers, I have distributors, retailers, and all that. I ask everyone to recommend best wine around $15 retail, $15-$20. Give me a red, give me a white. You can give me a maker, you can give me a, you could say Muscadet is the great, you can give me.
I mean,
anything.
Yeah,
kids are in their 20s. Yeah. I always say they're going to a dinner party, they got to step up. You know, spend 17, 18. You know, what's the best wine, red and white?
Maybe like Pepier Muscadet.
Okay.
And
so Muscadet on the whites aside.
Yeah, you know, it's friend. You know, maybe the, you know, La Pierre has a, what's it called?
Raison.
Yeah, Raison.
For the red?
Yeah, it's, again, Gamay, fresh, carbonic, crunchy, you know.
So that's the play.
Yeah.
For reds and whites to stay in that price range. Those are good choices. For good reason, you're not the first person who said that, just because, you know, there are not a ton of great wines in that price range. All right, so that's Raj Par's wine list. Like I said, I'll post everything. Raj, we're going to wrap up the show. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby and The Grape Nation hashtag. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby. Also subscribe to The Grape Nation podcast. We're on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Like I said, we will post Raj's wine list and book info on our social media sites. But let's go over that quickly again. I told everybody where they can go for your wines. So we talked about that. We talked about the wine club. The book is called The Sommelier's Atlas of Taste. It is available at Amazon and fine bookstores. I think the best thing would probably be to order it. If you want to follow Raj on social media, where do we go?
At Rajat Par.
That's very creative. All right. So, Raj, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
I always love having you on. You're not done. You're going to have to come back for some reason down the road.
I love to.
You can't say to me, well, wasn't I on a few times already? You're always welcome on the show.
Well, thank you.
Good luck with the book. So thank you to our guest, Raj Par. Raj just wrote Sommelier's Atlas of Taste. Thank you to everyone at Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.